Real quick before we start the show, just wanted to let you guys know you can get the show 2 days early by joining our Patreon. Even for a buck, you can listen to the show 2 days early. Go to patreon.com/analogtalk and we got a bunch of stuff over there. Check it out and enjoy the episode.
Hey, you guys, welcome back to another episode of Analog Talk, a film photography podcast. I'm your host, Tim.
I'm Chris.
And on today's show, we have Charles Peterson. Woo!
Hi, Charles. Hi. So we are very excited to chat with you. You've got a lot of stuff coming down the pipeline. But before we get into all of that, do you mind, for our listeners who may not know you, do you mind introducing yourself and giving us a background how you got into photography?
Sure. So, yeah, I'm Charles Peterson. And if you don't know who I am, I'm best known for my photographs of the Seattle grunge scene.
Yeah.
Back in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s. And, you know, I've been a photographer for as long as I can remember. Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Love it.
Yep. I'm 59 now. And so I think I had my first camera when I was 12 or something.
Yes.
Oh, great.
Do you remember what it was?
The first camera that I owned, you know, I would get them from school shooting like Arguses and stuff
like
that.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But then I had a Fujika SRT 101.
Nice.
Yeah. And then I think by the end of high school, I graduated to something like a Minolta XD11 or
I love that.
Agent Go.
So were you someone who's self-taught then, or did you have like a stint in any photo school?
Yeah. So I would say I primarily self-taught, but I took photography classes all through junior high and high school, mm-hmm. and then graduated with a Bachelor of Fine Arts in photography in college.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Awesome.
But that, you know, in university, it primarily was just me going to Ron Kerr, this one professor, and just kind of explaining to him what I was up to about every 3 months. And we'd have a long discussion, and then Ron would just, give me a passing grade. So I was really a matter of, I think in general, I think that something like photography is really best self-taught. So
yeah, especially nowadays with when there's like education so easy. I went to photo school as well, but it wasn't a fine arts. I kind of wish I had went that route versus this was like a school that was 10 months. It was like, we're going to teach you the business side. We're going to teach you like commercial photography and this and that. And I just knew I always wanted to photograph people. And I started out shooting bands and stuff. So like your work really, you know, I'm sure speaks to a lot of us, but I really like see myself in those live photos back in the day. Being able to go to school for something you love like that is like, there's nothing better. But I feel like, I feel like the fine arts would have, if that makes like, would have suited me a little bit better just because there would be more time in the dark room instead of like, oh, this is how you do your taxes. Like, I'll figure that out. Like,
yeah. I almost sometimes feel the opposite.
Yeah, like sure.
Okay. Yeah.
Nailed me down and said, learn how to do your taxes.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm an artist through and through. I've always been lousy with money and stuff.
Same.
Yeah. But you know, I guess it's the artistry that sets my work apart from a lot of others.
Absolutely, for sure.
It's a well-mined milieu of photography, so the music thing at this point. Yeah.
Man.
It's just sort of all how you approach it, look at it.
So yeah, talk to us about how that part of your career happened. I know you were at Sub Pop.
Yeah, so I went to University of Washington starting in 82, coming in from the suburbs of Seattle. And I quickly met the likes of Mark Arm, and he introduced me to Bruce Pavitt, and Bruce introduced me to Kim Thayil. And if you don't know who these people are, that's okay, but they're all now, you know, famous or semi-famous rock stars or record label heads or whatever.
Yeah.
And it just sort of was a small scene, snowballed like that. I had an interest in photography, so it was just kind of a natural fit. And I like to experiment, and the bands like to experiment. So, yeah, I was, but I'd also been influenced, you know, sitting in my living room in the suburbs, not only listening to The Clash and the Buzzcocks and Black Flag, but also looking at the works of Lee Friedlander and Gary Winogrand and Richard Avedon, Maury Fink, and the likes. So I knew that I wanted to kind of approach what my friends were doing from an artistic standpoint, sort of rewrite live music photography, as so to speak. You know, it's kind of a little bit grandiose in the mind of a 20-year-old. But
I love that that was your mindset so early on, too. It's not like you came back to this work and said, like, oh, well, there's art here. Like, while you were shooting, you knew you wanted to, you know, create this work with a purpose and have it be a certain thing.
And I understood the darkroom and how to print very early on. I had a darkroom in high school, and I the rudiments of dodging and burning and balancing your light. Yeah. And, you know, I used a flash, so you had to do that, or it just looked like a washed out photo you know, photo with too many shadows. But yeah, I to me, it was always, an artistic mindset versus a commercial mindset.
I love that.
So was it the art school in you that was always, because I love your shots are all black and white, as you can probably tell by my screen. I'm a black and white head. Like, I love it so much. It's my favorite thing in the world. It's just, what was your, like, what drawed you to that?
Yeah, I mean, that is largely from an economic standpoint. Okay. DIY standpoint, I guess. But also from a historic, my favorite photographers had all shot in black and white. Mm-hmm. And it's so much more forgiving, and you can do so much more with it. And all you have to do is, especially back in 1979, is spend an afternoon, you know, being a 16-year-old, spend an afternoon in a dark room trying to make a Type C print. And you're like, screw this. Yeah, it's a different matter now with color.
Totally.
I mean, I shoot primarily, my recent personal work is primarily color now, but that's a whole another thing. But yeah, no, I mean, you really, you know, you had to be a part of the process, and black and white was just fundamentally so much easier.
Yeah.
Well, bulk loading 100-foot rolls of Tri-X.
Sure.
Yeah, think of that with the darkroom stuff. Yeah, because I've tried color stuff, like printing once or twice, and man, what, it's just so much more work. And especially doing it without any sort of machinery, like just doing it in your bathroom is pretty chaotic.
And printing after the fact, there's so much more you can do with black and white, and so much, you know, compared to so much more forgiving in the highlights, and you don't have to deal with color shifts and you know, it's very, you know, it can be emotional, expressive, and you can crush the blacks to whatever nth degree you want. It's much easier to spot and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I'll ask you this, since you're primarily shooting color nowadays, do you ever look back at, like, is there any image you're like, man, that would look cool in color? Are you like pretty satisfied?
Content.
And, you know, content, I mean, yeah. I did shoot some color back then for sure. Yeah. And some of it's pretty great. And just that, especially with my open shutter and all the light swirls.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, also not as many people have seen the work because the bulk of it is in black and white, and if you're doing, say, a book or something, that it doesn't really kind of work that way, at least so far.
So it, like, stick out like a sore thumb, huh?
Yeah, both from just a artistic expression, and also from a production standpoint.
Yeah. When you throw that one color shot in there, you're really throwing like a wrench in the printer's in the printer's job right there.
Like I had this idea like with the Nirvana book that's coming out. I had this idea that we would just do the end sheets in color
okay.
on sort of the matte paper that goes on the end yeah. sheets. And it's kind of cool, but at the end of the day, it was just going to be a hassle, and right. it was just going to sort of, I think, take away from what we were trying to do inside the book. It
was
just,
totally.
Yeah, I was trying to add another sort of bell and whistle on top of it. I'm very intentional about what right. I do and how I present it to the world. And yeah, and I think I like to approach it from in the same way that, yes, my mentors approached it from, people, you know, my inspirations.
We talk a lot about bookmaking on the show and like what that process like what goes into that process. Can you talk to us about how it's been for you? I know it's been in the works for a while and we're all excited
yeah,
for February.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, this Nirvana book, Charles Peterson's Nirvana, it's on the publisher's Minor Matters Books, and they it's a local publisher who Michelle's worked with photographers from Aperture and Chronicle and did books with them for years, and so we've known each other, and Her focus is more on diversity and voices and whatnot, but she's also a music fan and longtime fan of my photography. So we were going to initially do pre-pandemic. We were talking about doing more of a retrospect of my grunge work,
then
I couldn't get my head wrapped around it. It was just too much work to go through. And so last summer, I just had idea of like, what about a Nirvana? And I'd thought about this for years, and people would poke me like, do a Nirvana book. And I always thought, oh, I don't have enough, or my material is not diverse enough and doesn't tell the complete history, so to speak.
Right.
Because there are big gaps, because I was just, I don't know, whatever. I was.
Yeah, sure.
I got a lot of excuses, reasons, whatnot, but... I got enough to make a bowl. So in the end, the family went out of town for the summer. I laid out, they went to France and had a great time, and I stayed at
home.
And
you got to work.
I got to work.
And I made like 300 little prints, you know, 8.5 by 11 prints, and laid them out through the kitchen and into the living room and, you know, back around and then just like put on Nirvana for 2 weeks and just started shuffling stuff.
Wow.
And then every once in a while I run to do a little more scanning and some printing and whatnot. So I got it to a pretty good point. And then I took it to Michelle and she's like, yeah, this can work. And then she worked on it. And we kind of, at one point it sort of, I went second thought the whole process. And added a bunch of images and took some others away, and it dangerously started veering towards what we labeled a band book versus book.
Yeah.
And then Michelle, because she's been through this whole process, she brought me back, and it very much became an art book at that point.
Wow.
And what we did essentially was to not make it a history, to not make it sort of overly clever, though, at the same time of like transposing images, is we kind of decided to jettison most, if not all, of the post and sort of backstage photos.
Okay.
And just really concentrate on, she's like, what do you do best? What did you do best with this band? And I was like, well, I photographing them live.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, what does the live mean to you? And to me, it was like, well, to me, it's transliterating their music, the sound of their music and their performance, you know, the emotion of their performance. So we, with that in mind, we essentially took like about a dozen shows and turned it into one single show almost, so to speak.
Oh, neat. Neat.
Oh, cool.
So it's, there's like six sections or seven sections that are like interchangeable really to the most part. But they have a song title associated with them, and you know, there's not a, it's not really a literate thing,
but it can be if you want, whatever. It's kind of like Kurt's music in a way. Like you can take it and make it mean anything you want, really. Transmutational.
Wow.
So when digging through that stuff, when you were getting all the prints and stuff together, did you find some stuff you forgot about or you haven't seen in forever? Like what was that experience like?
Yeah, no, for sure. You know, I mean, and the digital process now allows for that to much easier. There's stuff that I just really never wanted to touch in the dark room, or I just knew it was just going to be a real pain. And so now the ability to quickly scan and work on it in Photoshop, I could really, bring some images back to life, so to speak, and do it and do it. Yeah. I don't think one, a darkroom print or a digital print, one is better or worse. They're just different. And so, but we also had, we had for the book, we had duotones made as well, files.
Wow.
So by Thomas, and I forget Thomas's last name. He's back in Rhode Island and he's done duotones for, Aperture and, and Scully and books all for whatnot, like, the photographer, you name the big black and white photographers and he's done it. I mean, that's all he does is black and white duotones. So it's gorgeous. Yeah. But no, it was quite a process. And then essentially narrowed it down to like 90 images.
Wow.
Thereabouts, which is still from a production standpoint is still quite a few.
Yeah.
You know, but we certainly had enough. We have enough for a second volume if we ever decide.
Oh, yeah.
I love that you went from, like, I don't have enough to, like, well, it's going to be a big book. That's great.
Yeah. Well, people were laughing at me, my son especially, because I sort of on social media, as we were gearing up for the pre-sale, because Minor Matter's model is to do a pre-sale of the book, and the first 500 or so people get their name published in the book.
Oh, cool.
For publishers. And that just allows the book to move forward. She had three titles this spring. Mine, we sold 750 in like 8 hours.
Yeah.
Kind of cut it off at that point.
Like,
main thing at least, you know?
Yeah. It's very small print.
It just takes it took up a few pages, but it's cool. It's a cool thing.
It's like we said, it's an exciting thing. And, for the fans of Nirvana, they're going to be very, very happy with new stuff to look at they've never seen before. I want to ask you specifically about like the scene. Did you know when you were documenting all this stuff, did you know, like, were you like, this is it? Like, this is going to blow? Or were you just kind of like doing your thing? And then all of a sudden you're like, wow, there's way more people here than there were last time.
Yeah, I didn't. I think we were just kind of going along, and then all of a sudden I don't think any of us still, even to this day, like understand or realize just what sort of impact we truly had, or how big it got, or whatever. I think I wish I'd known sort of more in the moment, like, oh my god, like, this is I would have probably have done things different,
sure,
you know. But yeah, you just don't know. I mean, sometimes you end up with different priorities and chasing different unicorns. So, but I do have a lot of archives to work with. So
that's great.
I bet. Yeah, I wanted to ask you kind of to backtrack on the Sub Pop thing. Now, was that they would like send you out on assignment, or were you just like a guy that loved to go to shows? Like, what was that working with them like?
Well, I mean, you know, initially Sub Pop was just Bruce in his apartment, and it was just me bringing over some prints of my friend's bands who just
happened
to be starting to put out records on Sub Pop. After that, it sort of morphed into, I actually worked in through a lot of the early days. I worked at Auto Trader, making little news halftone prints for the publication, and bulk rolling film, and souping, like, 100 rolls of film a night from the agents out in the field. That sort of thing.
Wow! Whoa!
So it was kind of a funny job. I would soup a lot of my own film there. I would bulk load a lot of my own film there because I did the ordering as well.
Nice.
And it just was that, like, in your early 20s and you just Sometimes we'd work late on the job. Other times, business was dead, so we would get off early and still get paid the same, and then go head out to a show or whatever. So yeah, a lot of us were doing stuff like that where and when we could. And then it morphed into essentially the first secretary at Sub Pop when they had a one room office. I quit Auto Trader, did that. Then they got a warehouse downstairs. I had a dark room in there for a while.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was I was kind of more on a salary, and I'd go out and shoot ads and then supply some photos and pack some records and open some letters. And
yeah.
It sounds like, to me, that's like a dream job. Like, I would have loved to been like, the photographer at the record
label. I was also the only one. I had a Volkswagen van. So, and like, neither John Grove. So, I was also like the one who would go and deliver records around town and pick up bands at the airport.
So
to be
cool.
A part of something like that. Yeah.
I know.
I love that. I forget where, if it was on one of like Dave Grohl's, I forget what it was, where you were talking about they were talking about Sub Pop in the thing. And it was like, yeah, when the paychecks came out, like everybody rushed to the bank to try to cash their check. Yeah. It's just so funny. But it was like they didn't care. Like everybody was just like a part of it. You know what I mean? Like you're a part of this amazing world.
Yeah, I mean, and keep in mind, this was like pre-tech and manufacturing has declined, and there was just like not much going on in Seattle at the time. So yeah, so to be a part of something at least, versus just working in a Kinko's whatever, or Starbucks or something. It just was like, even that wasn't an opportunity then. It didn't have one on every block. There was only a few.
Right.
Yeah.
It was
just a different time and city. So
yeah, it's definitely a different time in regards to like photography in general. We talk a lot about like everybody thinks they're a photographer now because they have their phones. It would have been way different if everybody was documenting Nirvana like with their iPhones. You know what I mean? Like to be a photographer in that era, it was like that meant something. Not everybody knew how to do it. It wasn't as accessible. It's not as easy to just like pick up a digital camera and go. Like you had to know what you were doing, you know?
There's stuff I so wish we had back then. Like I've got like this great Profoto A10 flash that put this little wireless hockey puck on your camera. And then
that would have been cool.
Whereas before I had like literally, like a cable to the camera and then a cable to a power pack, and it was just kind of a tangle, and then trying to roll put that somewhere while you had changed film
So when did it start to slow down with shooting shows? Like when did you start to kind of get out of that whole scene?
More like late 90s, early 2000s. It just is not. I felt like I'd kind of done it, and there really wasn't the, at least in Seattle, or if I wanted to stay in Seattle, there wasn't, I don't know, much call for it as business wise. I still do the occasional. I like to do the occasional big show here and there, interesting show. I mean, I just photographed Mudhoney a couple weeks ago at the Crocodile. And now, I shot it with a Leica M10 monochrome. It's like, okay. But you still have to edit and post-process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, so how was that for you being like a predominant film shooter, growing into the times?
Yeah.
Was it hard for you to kind of switch into the digital world?
It was definitely hard for me. And I succumbed to it a lot later than most other photographers. I think when everyone was buying these like uber expensive Canon, whatever, was 16 megapixel for $7,000. I went and bought an Imacon scanner. So
there you go. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, for ten grand, but I got a lot more for me. I got a lot more use out of that.
Totally.
Well, at a certain point, it just wasn't affordable to do new work anymore film. So I think what my first digital body was like a Nikon D200 or something.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, but now that I shoot like a digital, I love it. And I've shot M's for Well, I've shot M's since mid-90s, you know.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
So that's been your, Leica's been your main camera system since the 90s?
Well, no, I still used a Nikon a lot up until like 10 years ago or so. But yeah, I rarely, the Nikon now lives on the copy stand to do as a, because my Imacon died a couple years back.
Yeah. Mm.
So the Nikon lives on a copy stand.
See it there.
There it goes. Yeah.
And that's a great way of archiving totally. It's a D850 and get a pretty good scan. And it's quick. It's a lot quicker than the Imacon. I like the look of the Imacon scans better. But
yeah, it's so much faster. It's crazy how much faster it is.
Yeah, I still need to convert over to the
camera scanning.
The camera scanning. Yeah, because I'm a flatbed guy. I sit here and it's like, for like three hours.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of, you know, we talk about flatness issues. I have an 850 here, Epson 850 on my desktop, and it just does not work for me. So
medium
format,
it's okay. I do miss the darkroom at times.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you were still printing or developing, or do you shoot film at all anymore? Or?
I haven't shot film in like 10, 15 years, maybe.
Okay.
14
we'll
years.
We'll send you a roll, get you back into it.
Yeah, we'll get you back into it.
Yeah, I've got a bunch of film laying around, and I still have a couple film cameras. I've got a Rolleiflex and a Leica 3. Yeah, I had to give up the darkroom primarily for health reasons. Really.
Right, I was gonna say that's like
I don't know. That's kind of has always been sort of a bit of an untalked about thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it was literally killing me, and even still wearing a respirator, rubber gloves, and all that stuff, it was still not good for me. And I could never truly have a truly good ventilated space because it was always kind of, you know, makeshift.
I was like downstairs makeshift, like in the basement. Like I knew it. I was like, this can't be safe. Like I'm.
Yeah. Yeah. But the prints are amazing. I love the process with it and all that. I may be able to figure out how to do it again someday. So
yeah, that'd be cool.
What do you got to teach your kids?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the problem is I sold off everything and now it's expensive to buy it back. So it's
now it is. Old. Yep.
Yes.
Nobody was anticipating that.
Yeah.
I remember I sold my photography school camera, which was a Mamiya 645 AFD for like $800 in like 2008. And I was like, buy film. I'm going to shoot this digital stuff. And then little did I know it was going to come back into my life in such a powerful way that now I'm like, I wish I still had my school camera. So I went to look it up and they're like, you know, $2,500.
Yeah.
Which is still cheaper than what they were when we bought it, but still.
Yeah. The one I regret is the Hasselblad Super Wide. It sold a few years back.
Oh, you had a Super Wide. Oh.
I wish I had that still. That's how I used, I shot a book of breakdancers in the late 2000s. And I used that and Mamiya 6 and Mamiya 7.
Nice.
For it, yeah.
Man.
What was your first Leica film camera? The M3? That's the one you kept?
I actually had an M2 and it really, I don't know, I didn't gel with it. And then I sold it. This was in the early 90s. And then it was 96, I got a Leica M6. Finally, the used one. And that I was like, okay, with the meter in it and everything. And the wide frames. And I was like, okay. So I started to gel with that. And I used it primarily like for shooting some backstage kind of stuff and travel work and personal stuff. And then I had M6s and M7s and sold all those stupidly. Now they're worth a fortune.
I know.
Then I had an M8 and an M9 and then an M10. And now I have an M10R, black paint body, which, they will bury me with.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know. The direction Leica is going in doesn't agree But the M10R is pretty great as far as what I do or want to do. My daughter's name is Laika, by the way.
We were gonna get there because I I tried with my husband and he was like, no.
That's amazing.
Does she shoot at all? That's why I said you gotta teach your kid. I mean, her name's Laika, you gotta be like, I'm sorry, honey.
She just has a Fuji Instamatic.
Okay.
Polaroid, but in a phone, you know.
Yeah.
My son, he's 14, and he wanted for Christmas. I hope he won't hear this, but he wanted a camera for Christmas, so he's getting his first camera. I got a Sony A6300.
Nice.
Oh, great! Those are great.
Yeah. He can take it to Hawaii on vacation and just do whatever he wants to do with it. So.
I love it.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about your archive and stuff. Like, how often are you digging through that stuff? Is this like you come up with an idea, you remember a shot? Like, what is?
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't even imagine having the photos you have.
Well, it's just almost a daily task, toil, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I get requests all the time for various stuff. You know, bands from back then or people looking to do sort of more images, use them for murals or walls. There's all kinds of uses for them, clubs, that sort of thing. I've even done a Braille book of one of my images.
Oh, wild.
Whoa.
So, yeah, so I'm kind of, but obviously I'm kind of still always culling with ideas in mind. I still like looking to do more of a grunge retrospective. So I do have a Lightroom collection of 100 images that could possibly be for this, you know, and then kind of just keep switching in and out on that or adding stuff. I'm like, well, if I add something, I need to take something away, you know,
right.
That kind of thing. Yeah, and Lightroom's great that way to kind of edit. I still prefer for final sequencing on a project like the Nirvana book to make prints and to lay it out and to go print based. It's a lot quicker. It's a lot easier to not get lost.
Yeah. Plus, you can stand back and like look at all of it and be like, okay, this does work. Or, you know, like, I feel like that's really the only way to like, when you're in, at least in the final stages, to make sure and feel good about it.
So, I'm just right now, just like, I've got all this stuff with the Nirvana book launch I should be working on. Yeah. But of course, I've also been kind of just playing with my personal project that I've been shooting the last few years. And that's called Photographs for Ambient Music.
Oh, and cool.
I've been shooting that primarily with a Leica M10 and a 135 millimeter lens.
Oh, 135. Cool.
And the APO. It's just stunning. But it's essentially skyscapes and landscapes.
Oh, wow.
Taken from the house or on my walks or most of the work is done within, say, a 2-square-mile radius of the house. And it's color, very minimalist. I'm sort of approaching it from, some of it has airplanes in it, bridges, towers, but just sort of like how we are interacting with nature and the environment, but not in a literal sense. It's really emotional work. I don't know. I haven't put all the words together for it yet. You kind of have to see it.
Yeah.
But I've probably taken like 50,000 images for it, and I've boiled it down to around 50 or 60 at this point. And that's another thing. That's what's, you need to, I always stress editing. Like, you just got to edit, and then get it down to a point and just go like, well, yeah, okay, I've been doing this for 3 years, but you know what? I've got like these images, but I can do better. Or I can, now I'm starting to see or whatever. I think everybody wants to make a project every 6 months or something, you know?
Agreed.
And sometimes it can just take years of just working away at something and then.
Totally. I mean, that's so true because I put out like a little zine years ago, but I like just from, if I'd taken a little bit more time with that idea, You know, it's people are like, okay, it's done. And then you're like, oh, this would have been great for the thing I put out a year ago. Like, I wish I had just not done that. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, you have to let it percolate sometimes.
Totally.
Yep.
Yeah, it's like having the patience to really just know that the project's going to be a long one and just feel it out versus being like, well, you know, if I want to get it out by this date, I should do this. And like, then you're rushing, you're like shooting stuff just to like shoot and like,
yeah,
yes. Yeah. Not great.
Well, I feel like too, Chris, you could always revisit that stuff too and make it into something else. Cause I beat myself up about that stuff for like zines that I've made in the past where I'm just like, well, those pictures are dead now. And it's like, well, no, the 50 people that bought the zine, you know, they saw them, but what about, you know, it doesn't really, you gotta.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't worry about that. Yeah. Recontextualization is everything.
It's interesting. It must be interesting for you to like have an ongoing project and then have something that you're like, you know, going back into the archives to kind of curate, like the difference between like, this is the body of work that I have to work with versus like, I can go out and create something new. Which do you prefer? Is it just, they're just so different that.
Well, they're just, you know, so different. I mean, really, like this new project, it's just, I have to go walk this damn dog of ours like 3 or 4 times a day. It's just, there's no choice. I don't get to go. He's a rescue American Staffordshire Terrier who would just rip apart, sweetheart, but she'd just rip apart any other dog that she'd encounter.
Yeah.
So
I
get to just go like let her in the dog park and look at my phone. So I will go out on these walks. And for me, it's like, okay, another aspect of this project is that you don't need to, our everyday life is spectacular and surreal. And if you just take the time to look up, you know, if you just take the time to look up from your phone and
totally,
and it's just about like, yeah, constantly looking. And that's when I do that, you know, and then the archive material. Yeah. Like that is just, I mean, especially this coming year, I've got a museum show supposedly lined up for the end of the year.
I was gonna ask. That's great.
You know, a bunch of launch stuff.
Just one more question on the work of the past. How was your archiving? Is it
did you play it smart, like
oh, I need this picture, do you know where that negative sleeve is, like which, you know, like how's that? Because I always try to work on my archiving and trying to know where everything is and stuff like that. Or is it kind of just, you know where it is, but it's kind of like over in the corner and you got to dig for it.
Yeah, it's pretty, I mean, it's pretty haphazard. I mean, I can obviously, like, if it's a specific band, I can find it. I can find that band very quickly. But then something like Nirvana or Pearl Jam, it can sometimes take time to drill down on stuff. Okay. But for them, yeah. And then there's just a bunch of stuff that's, I'm a little ADD, so my file naming when I do digitize it can sometimes be a problematic. But I got it to a point where, yes, it does work for me.
Okay, good.
It probably wouldn't work for anyone else.
You know? I'm in that boat, yeah.
People come over and they're like, oh my God, you look so organized. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's because there are all the negatives are in nice gray boxes. But if you go into the box, it can become a little different matter. And I have a big long line of flat files. It's like, well, whatever you do, just don't ask me to actually find something in those flat files.
Right.
At least quickly. Yeah. We just moved, to my credit, we moved house like after 13 years, we moved house last year.
Oh, wow.
And that was major. Yeah.
Yeah, I bet.
I went pretty quickly, so I didn't have time to go through stuff like you might normally want to. And we were doing remodel on the new house and the old house at the same time. So,
did you find anything you forgot about?
Yeah, not really. No.
So that means you're good at archiving then. You're good.
Yeah. There's like this one. Though there's just one, and sometimes you think, God, did I just dream that? Like I have this one shot that I took of Snoop Dogg, and I can't find it anywhere.
Oh no!
I know my son's into hip hop. I know he'd love that, but I know I saw it. Like I saw it, like in the old house, where I was looking through some slides. I'm like, oh yeah, I'll put this in this sleeve for like selects or something. And then I don't know.
Oh man. That's great.
It'll turn up. Don't worry.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure. Like one of those recurring dreams, you know.
Like,
or it'll haunt you forever. Like, where's the Snoop Dogg photo?
I know you're here somewhere.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with a couple listener questions for Charles right after this message from our sponsor.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Just wanted to pop in here quick and let you guys know about our Patreon-only Develop and Hang Nights. Now, we've done a bunch of these already. They're a ton of fun. We develop some film. We talk shop. We also try to get a former guest for these. So if that sounds like something you're interested in, head over to patreon.com/analogtalk. Like we always say, Patreon is the best way to support the show. Thanks, guys.
All right, guys, this is the part of the show where we take a question from one of our listeners. We're actually going to hit Charles with two today. So the first one comes from friend of the show, Bob Price, that he asks, favorite band to photograph / nicest band to work with?
You know, I've been asked this before, and it always comes back to Mudhoney. I mean, and somebody actually was just doing a Facebook post on this a while back about how they had met Mudhoney back in the doing their photo back in the 90s and talking about how they were just so nice and accommodating and as long as you bought them a six pack of beer, like you can just do anything on that band. It's a little bit of a bias because I've been friends with the band, you know, even before they were Mudhoney. So, they were great guys. But, you know, I've had like interesting Usher, like somebody who I had no clue who this guy was, honestly. And then he just like let me be a fly on the wall for like two and a half hours backstage for Vibe. And I just was like, you know, I like that kind of professionalism too.
Right.
Like where it's just sort of like, you know, this is, you know, early on in his career, but he's still playing the, you know, 10,000 seat arena.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he just was like, okay, I'm just going to trust this guy to do what he needs to do. And, you know, I didn't like try to interject in like business decisions or meetings that he was having I knew when to like, you know, slink off into the other room or do whatever. Yeah. And that's what you kind of have to do as a photographer. So, and it's not necessarily always about who's nicest, but sometimes it's just about like who's most professional too.
Yeah. Mm.
Just to kind of bounce off that answer just a little bit, does it ever, I mean, I guess it wouldn't bother you, but is it ever just like you're always kind of referred to as the Nirvana photographer? Like do you ever feel like there's
Seattle guy?
Yeah. Do you ever just, is there ever kind of like a negative feeling towards that, or is it just kind of like you know, you're like, there's so much more than that. Or
yeah,
I think as I had that like more in maybe the like my late 30s, 40s, early 40s. Now I've, you know, now that I'm pushing 60, I'm like, okay, I've gotten over it. I've embraced
it.
Yeah.
Not everybody gets that opportunity, or, you know, so what if like I did my greatest hits in my 20s? Okay. But yeah, there was definitely, you know, particularly in the late 90s, it's kind of why I ran off and did a bunch of trips to Vietnam and did some work there and did some different things. Just to prove almost as much to prove to myself that I'm a photographer or whatever, you know.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, you just have to come to grips with that stuff and, you know, just be. It's like the band that has been going on for 30 years. If they're not okay playing their greatest hit, you know, after all that time, then they're not going to make it for 30
years.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Good man, point. Good parallel.
Yeah. Just curious, man. All right. So we'll do one more listener question for you. And this one comes from Reed Hathcock. And he wanted to know, worst camera damage incident from a stage diver or guitar swing or any.
yeah. I mean, from a stage diver, it was definitely, and it happened a couple of times, really. It was getting the hot shoe snapped off. On my flash.
Dang.
The Vitar 285. And
jeez.
Yeah. Eventually just bought an aftermarket metal one. Screwed it on.
Smart. Yeah.
Yeah. But that was kind of the prime concern, really. And I never did, you know, I would photograph with a 24, I would photograph inches away from the guitar neck.
Yeah,
I never did get hit by a guitar neck, so
good.
I got pretty good at just swaying,
dodging.
Yeah.
But I did, you know, when I was in high school, I ruined a very inexpensive camera for my mom at the time on a that was my first introduction plan. I've dropped a Leica lens before. Screwed that up. I watched my son nudge a Leica lens when he was like four or five, just nudge it, and we were on vacation. Nudge a 35mm off of the coffee table on the tile floor with his foot.
Oh no.
Right in front of me. Just that dumb, like, son, and just whatever. Like, what's going to happen now if I do this? So, yeah, it's just mostly been stuff like that. I'd
like to say good answers, but, man, they hurt. Yeah. They hurt a little bit.
Yeah, flash off. Jeez.
Yeah.
All right. Give them the tough questions, Chris.
Okay. You ready?
Uh-huh.
So... We ask every guest, what is your all-time favorite? If you're stranded on a desert island, and we preface, this desert island is magical. It's not real. So there's a photo lab, there's batteries, there's anything that you might need to, you know.
To keep your camera going.
To keep your camera going. What's your all-time, if you had to only use one, what is it?
Oh, boy. yeah, we had all that. Man, I guess if you're on a desert island, it might be a little bit limiting. But, man, I had an M6 with like a 0.58 viewfinder.
Wow.
And that was a pretty sweet camera. But as far as cameras I own, like I said, the Leica M10-R, like that does it for me. And I do have a Leica M monochrome as well. And that's...
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, the monochrome.
But, boy, yeah, I've been through a lot of... I like my cameras.
Us
too. Yeah, we know all about that.
That is a difficult question.
It's tough.
Especially when you're like, you know, think like, oh, I'll slim down. I'll get rid of some stuff. And you're like, well, I can't sell that because like... I'll need it for whatever, whenever, you know?
Yep.
Yeah. And my 28 Summicron F2 lens is what I like most. You know.
A dream. It's
unless
a dream setup.
Unless I'm doing something, like I said, this latest project I've been shooting mostly long lens, 135, 90, 75, which are kind of 135 is considered a strange walk around lens for a Leica, but now it's nice. It's like, okay, you really have to work at this abstraction,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And now I put on a 28 or something to go shoot like a landscape or a skyscape. And it's like, yeah, it's like an iPhone photo, you know?
Yep.
Right.
Whereas this is more like, oh, there's these like little elements going on here.
Totally. Yeah.
It's a good practice to do something like that, to use a lens that's absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I like, you know, it's why I shot breakdancers on medium format when I could have just whipped out a digital SLR and banged away. But I like that. I think that challenge sometimes is what sort of, you know, makes the art appear.
Yep.
Right. Yeah, being intentional about your tool too.
Yes, it is.
Obviously, that work looks completely different than anything you would have done with the digital camera. So
yeah,
it's cool. Okay, yeah. Second part. There's a two part question. We forgot to tell you that. But is there anything? I know you've probably shot a bunch of stuff, but is there any cameras out there that you're like wanting to get or like wanting to try? Maybe like large format or anything like that. Have you got your eye on anything recently?
Yeah, there's nothing I can really afford at the moment. It's an ongoing problem. If I had my druthers, well, I would like to, and this goes back to the first question, I actually would like to pick up an M6. The new reissue would be awesome, but I would for an old used one, but even this, God, they're just so expensive. I don't know how much I would actually use it. I'm a little bit fascinated by something like the Hasselblad X2, like that sort of pseudo medium format.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are neat too.
Yeah.
Didn't you try one of those out, Chris? Isn't that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. I don't know. I'd have to see. I'm not a big fan of electronic viewfinders, so. More and more the camera choices are becoming limited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The electronic viewfinder is like still so jarring because I use that for work. I'm an on-set photographer. And just going from analog to that and like oh, I can look through. It's like it's weird, you know?
It is weird. It's weird.
Yeah. And then, I mean, the only cool thing is like what I do like is, you know, when you change your exposure, it like lightens up as you're looking at
it. That's true. Yeah.
But other than that,
I mean, what really appeals to me with the Leica M rangefinder is that I have generally on a lot of my shots, particularly when I'm in the moment, like say shooting bands or my kids or something like that, I'm not looking through the viewfinder.
Mm.
And the Leica viewfinder, it's so imperfect as it is, you know, it's really just these like not giving you the perspective or anything like that. And so I pretty much just through muscle eye memory know where the image is going to fall right outside the frame lines. But at the same time, it seems to liberate me from feeling the need to be looking through the viewfinder.
Mm. Yeah, you're right.
So, and then I know the micro movements of the lens where the focus will fall. And so I can actually follow focus with an M.
Wow.
Mm. Wow.
I've had peers watch me work with one, and even peers who've worked with rangefinders, and they're like, wow, you're pretty handy with that.
It just is kind of, but
at the end of the day, it's whatever works for you, you know?
Totally.
And, yep.
Totally.
Yeah. DSLRs, again, like, I think maybe because of my astigmatism in my eye,
okay.
By the end of the day, working with an SLR, I would just feel like my eye wanted to fall out of it.
Yeah.
And I get that same feeling with the EVF. So I think it's having to look at something so close, you know? An SLR, it's a mirror on that top of the body, and EVF, it's a tiny TV in there, so...
Crazy.
It's so weird. Yeah.
Whereas with the M, you're just looking straight through glass, except for the little focus patch in the middle.
Right. Right.
Or I'm just some sort of purist snob. I don't know.
That's okay, right. Too.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Really looks great on the coffee table of my yacht, let me tell you.
same here. God.
Charles, this has been fantastic. Thank you for taking the time to chat with us. We're very excited for your book.
Can't wait.
This is the part of the show where you can plug any of that stuff. So where can everybody pre-order? Where can they find you on Instagram?
Yeah, so it's coming out February 20th. Kurt's birthday is the release date.
So
And it's for pre-sale up until then, both the regular edition and the special limited edition with a print. There's 100 of those and a print and a special dust jacket. And that's at minormattersbooks.com. My Instagram, charles.peterson.photographer, Facebook and Twitter and all that. You can look that stuff up. But I'm primarily active on Instagram.
Yeah. Perfect. It's the best one.
Yeah. For what that's worth.
Yeah, for what that's worth. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you, Charles. This has been a pleasure. And thank you again for taking the time.
Thanks so much.
And you're welcome.
Good luck with the book.
Well, I'm going to go walk the dog and maybe take a few pictures now. So.
There you go.
Yeah,
love it.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, guys. We'll see you in the next one.
Bye.
Bye.
First off, Kristen, I would love to thank Charles for coming on the show. What a legend. Such a great conversation. It was great getting to talk to you. Can't wait to pre-order this book. Such a Nirvana head, such a grunge head. Love the 90s. We're in awe over this episode. Like, we're so glad we got to talk to you. Such an amazing story. Such a great body of work. Guys, check out his work. His socials will be linked below. Pre-order the book. Do the whole thing. Thanks again, Charles, for taking the time. We really appreciate it. Guys, that's going to take us to Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/analogtalk. For only $1, you can get the show 2 days early. We also have our Patreon-only develop and hang nights over there. A bunch of stuff in the archive and a link to the Discord. So that's really cool. For all the Patreons that already help support the show, guys, we do not know what we would do without you. We appreciate each and every single one of you. Again, patreon.com/analogtalk. That's going to wrap it up for this week's episode. What a killer episode. I think we have one more left in the books before we call it a year. Isn't that crazy? It's been another year. Wild. So keep shooting, guys. We'll see you soon with an all new episode. And yeah, later.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.